The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Kurt Benrud with the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Sci-Fi. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
I'm Susie Pratt. I'm reading The Patient Stars by Ryan Simcoe. "Just wait," he said. "This will be the best part." A small bar in Cleveland, somewhere my memory only vaguely recalls after all this time. It wasn't the bar I was looking at. It was his smile. A smile like a supernova, spectacular, blinding, beautiful, and threatening to collapse my world into nothingness. And it wasn't the gin and tonic I wanted to taste. "I will run and you will follow," he leaned in close, letting his breath run over my cheek. "Electricity, heart racing, and we'll let fate decide the rest." Everything about Earth feels so long ago. Cleveland may not even be a place anymore, lost to time and change like so much I've seen. I don't need to remember much about Earth, though. All I need to remember is the feeling when he pulled me in and let our lips lock. Then I knew I was part of his game. The next morning, the note said only, "Come and find me. I'm waiting across the patient stars." There were only three colonies back then, Luna, Mars, and Ganymede. I did not know where he had gone. I was left with no clue, no sign. So I took the only lead I had. I went to the spaceport and bought a ticket on the first ship leaving Earth. 5 million people across three worlds. He was somewhere there, waiting. All I had to do was find him. But these worlds weren't static. They were ever morphing, changing, developing at a rate that would have left 21st century China jealous. The colonies were steel mazes running along the surface like varicose veins, growing day by day. I started my search in the frozen halls of Ganymede, where heating was expensive but synthetic alcohol was cheap. I gave his description 1,000 times in 1,000 places. Sleek black hair, eyes like polished jade, skin like marble crafted by Bernini. I looked in the bars, in the winding residence halls that spiraled into the rock, and along the long glass surface corridors where a yellow sun was only a memory. I did not find him there. Next, I went to Mars, where the red dust seemed to seep through the walls and coat everything in a rusty haze. I worked in the terraforming teams and spent every minute of my free time wandering, every day a different bar, a different restaurant, a different biosphere park meant to resemble the distant Earth, all the while forever wiping the fine dust from my eyes. I checked the colonist registries. I searched the net for signs of him. I spoke his name to every person I met. Then I traveled to Luna, where many corridors were so tight that two people could not walk side by side. By then, the first commercial interstellar ships had begun to launch, spreading mankind across half a dozen stars. Every time I turned, I thought I caught a glimpse of him in the crowd, but then he vanished. I would catch a smile, a flash of ivory skin, and then nothing. I began to think he was only a dream my young mind had worked up. He was too beautiful, too perfect. And there was no chance to beat fate at its own game. This was all foolish. But then I saw it. In a corner of the newspaper on Luna, in a plain white space in the classified so small I almost missed it. "Come and find me. I am waiting across the patient stars." The next day I boarded a starship, leaving behind the sun's pole forever. "Can't you imagine it?" he asked. "All these worlds, all these places, and we are just starting to reach them." A hotel room in Cleveland, tucked beneath the covers, it was a private universe composed only of us, of his scent, of his touch. "We've only just discovered plant life on another planet. Imagine how many more worlds there are, how many places there are to see." His enchanting smile again, and his mischievous glint in his eyes, barely discernible through the faint moonlight. Who would want to spend their whole life here when there are an infinite number of stars in the sky? I wanted to say something cheesy about the stars in his eyes, but his lips had already found mine again. 40 million people across 7 systems. Yet it was not only the odds of population and distance I faced, but of time. It took me 2 months to reach Perilous, and 20 years had passed for everyone else. What if he had gone to another world? He may have landed 10 years ago, or he could still be on a ship watching worlds pass by, waiting to step out into a time when I was nothing but an old woman driven mad by her quest. Such was his game of fate. Perilous was small, smaller than even Ganymede. Gray halls, gray rocks, a population more optimistic than it had any right to be. I did not stay there long. 32 Earth years, a few months of my time, Agama. It was a world with a red sun that filled the sky and an alien jungle untouched by intelligent life, ripe for mankind. Its population alone was 52 million when I landed. Mankind was expanding like a gas released from its solar container, spreading to fill every space available. It was useless to give his description anymore. I simply watched, ever observant. I watched the advertisements on screens, the posters on walls, every picture in the news, searching. Would he make himself known? Would our meeting be a grand affair as I burst into his office after tracking him for weeks from a name in the paper? Would I simply email him after finding a familiar post on the net? Or would it be a moment of accidental eye contact in a crowded room, a brief pause of shock and held breath as we realized the odds we had overcome? As time passed, I realized I would not find the answer to my question on Agama. I stayed for a whole year before I left. It was a beautiful world, but I still had something more beautiful to find. 600 million people across 21 worlds, not even counting Earth. A new inhabitable planet was discovered every few months. Ships could not leave the Sol system fast enough. 18 Earth years for a trip to a world where rivers of molten metal flowed freely. People lived only along the twilight ring of a planet which never turned. 45 years, a planet of snow with the most beautiful flowers I had seen in my life, and by then, I had seen a lot. The summers were warm enough to thaw the equator, but each season lasted only a single month. As I traveled and searched, the universe grew around me. I never knew what to expect each time I stepped off the ship onto a new planet. I was also aware that my information about each world would be decades old by the time I arrived. I had no way to directly communicate over the vastness of interstellar space, no way to expand my search beyond each planet's own network. 3 billion people across 36 worlds. He could be anywhere, any time. Should I stay on one world? Would he? Would he stay close to Earth or go as far as the universe would take him? I already knew the answer to that. 300 Earth years, 1 year my time. 187 billion people. 106 worlds. And even that data was long since outdated. Mankind had spread itself so far that it could not keep track of its distant cousins anymore. I once heard a theorem to predict the chance of finding your soulmate on Earth. It was not promising, and it assumed a population of only 6 billion. What is the chance of meeting them twice with over 30 times as many people across 5 centuries? It was no use to think about. I would find him again, despite all the odds of the universe. I arrived on a desert planet in a binary star system. A man would die of heat stroke in less than 30 minutes on the surface, but the colonists built their tunnels underground, tapping into the most beautiful ecosystem I had seen yet. It was a world of bioluminescent plants and fungus, where the walls glowed in an eternal twilight. It was also the first world where I met someone who had never heard of Earth. I wished I could meet him again here, in a surreal dream gently lit by moss, surrounded by a subterranean forest. He would love this world. I hoped he had already passed through, just to experience its beauty before the next hop of his voyage. The thought of being close to him, of sharing this experience, even if through different times, made me happy. 2 months my time, 110 Earth years. Human engineering had begun to push ever closer to the limit, yet was still walled in by the demon of relativity. I began to run into a problem. People could not understand me. During my jumps from world to world, human language and culture had continued to evolve, while my own speech didn't. I had to communicate through the use of a computer translator now. The planet Briorion, a mountainous jungle world where people had begun to build floating cities. I could only glean a few familiar sounds in the spoken language. The letters on the signs and screens only vaguely resembled the Latin alphabet. Briorion reminded me of Agama, but I no longer felt as though I belonged, and all my trips between the stars, this was the first world where I realized I was no longer the same. I was alone, a human from a planet that was part of mankind's history, not its future. I began to leave messages on the net, files that would wait for his name to appear before contacting him. They would be patient, waiting decades, centuries, even millennia. Perhaps he would find my trail of breadcrumbs and know I was there still searching. Yet even then, I knew there would be no way for him to catch up to me. He would receive the message years too late. I would already be on another world, but he would at least know I was there. Somewhere. Over 10 trillion people, over 1,000 worlds. Humans had begun to change. People were spread thousands of light years apart and growing ever more distant. Memories of a city long in the past, on a planet where this all began, seemed distant. One thing was still clear in my mind, though, a kiss, a caress, and a promise to play a game across the stars. I could not say I had a home. I could not say I even understood any of the worlds I stopped on. I spoke a language long since abandoned. I could only communicate through a computer tapped into archives of dead tongues. Another jump, another world. I would stay long enough to see the people, to see the planet, and to leave a message, then move on. Another jump. Each planet was a new wonder, a new culture, a version of humanity I had never seen. Another jump. Yet I still realized I could only see a fraction of all the worlds. For everyone I visited, another 100 were colonized. I wondered where he was, how many places he'd seen. I had dreams of telling him the wonders I'd witnessed, the people I'd met. Perhaps we'd never meet again. But we were together in spirit. We were both travelers, witnessing the growth of humanity into something grander, more wonderful. Such was his game of fate. Another jump. I lost count. Galactic population, unknown. Inhabited worlds, unknown. I was on Infinity's End, 8 parsecs from Earth. Infinity's End was barely more than a rock, a self-contained city established as a base on the Milky Way's edge. It was here they were building the first void ship. Even relativity had been conquered, and now new paths lay open. The Milky Way was not enough anymore. Now mankind had its eyes set on the large Magellanic Cloud, and so did I. I sat in crowded pavilion, a bag filled with my belongings at my feet. The void ship's journey began tomorrow. 20,000 people were ready to set off for a new galaxy. The journey would be a long one. I would be very old before it finished. But I felt that the sight of a new galaxy with infinite possibilities would be a fitting journey's end. I wondered about him, about where he was. I had not managed to find him, but I still feel as though I had won his game. It was not about the odds. It was about seeing the stars. I got up for a moment and turned to a nearby food stall to purchase a meal. When I turned around, I found a small piece of paper placed atop my bag. Confused, I picked it up. I pulled my small personal device from my pocket to prepare to scan and translate the text for me, when I realized I didn't need to. The note was handwritten in characters I had not seen another person use in many, many years. The void ship leaves tomorrow, my love. Let's travel together to the patient stars. I spun, scanning the crowd. It couldn't be, could it? The odds were too impossible, too astronomical. My heart raced as I carefully folded the note and put it in my pocket. The void ship left tomorrow, and I would be on it. I wondered what the chances were of two specific people meeting on a ship of 20,000. Pretty good, I'd say.
I'm Kurt Benrud. This is Departure Gate 34B by Carrie English. I've never liked this airport. The endless corridors of white on white remind me of a hospital. But this is the only place I can talk to Stuart after the heart attack. He's not always here, but I come every day to look for him. Today he's sitting in his favorite spot in the departure gate, a corner seat connected to a low table. I tried sitting on the table once, but we can't talk unless I sit on his right, where I was for the trip to Hawaii. I sit down beside him. Travelers flow like a river behind us, boarding passes clutched in their hands, cell phones pressed to their ears. Their suitcase wheels hum and click on the tiles like tiny freight trains charting a course between Starbucks and Cinnabon. "Did you remember to stop the paper?" I ask. His sigh is like wind soughing through the doorways of an abandoned farmhouse. He looks at the floor for a moment before he answers. "The kids are doing well," he says. "Aaron finished his residency. Anna made the dean's list again. She'll be starting an internship in June." I want to hold his hand, but that doesn't work anymore, so I lean in close instead. "I got us a suite with a hot tub. Think you're up to that, old man?" He folds his hands together in his lap, twisting his wedding ring with the thumb and forefinger of his right hand. "It's been 2 years, Marion." His voice is soft, but the flirtatious whisper I long to hear sounds like patience instead. "2 years? We've been married for 30, Stu. What's 2 years compared to that?" "It's time, Marion. Time to move on." He's been moody since the heart attack, and I hate it when he gets this way. I get up to leave, but he reaches into his pocket, and then it's my wedding ring he's holding. He opens his hand to show it to me. My chest tightens. I look up at the ceiling. The white tiles won't stay in their squares, and their gray flecks go blurry. I remember that day 2 years ago. Paramedics. Stuart's agonized gasp. How I nearly lost him. "But you're fine now," I tell him. "We're fine." "Yes, I'm fine. But we're not." At first I think it's only me who has to blink back tears. But then I see it's him, too. People around us begin to stare and look away, uncomfortable in their politeness. "You're making a scene, Stu. People are staring at us." "Not us, Marion. They're staring at me. They can't see you." "What do you mean they can't see me? I'm right here." He tells me to look at my boarding pass. So I look. Gate 34B. "It's 34B, isn't it? Always 34B. Our gate for Hawaii, 2 years ago. We never went." "Because of your heart attack." "No, Marion. Because of yours. Because you died." The floor across the gate stands open. The jetway dark beyond. I close my eyes. "Don't do this, Stu. Can't we have Hawaii? We've waited so long." The stretcher feels stiff and cold beneath me. Mask on my face. Straps tight across my chest. Wheels clicking like train cars over the hospital's white tile. "I wanted it too, Marion. His voice breaks, but he holds it together. I wanted it too. A gate agent turns on the light in the jetway. She pastes on a smile and tells us that boarding will begin soon. I look down the carpeted tunnel. Posters of beaches and palm trees line the collapsible walls. Stu looks too. He takes a long breath before he turns back to me. It's time to board, Marion. They're holding the gate for you. I've got my carry-on on my shoulder, a gift from the kids now that retirement meant we could travel. I grip the handles tighter and shake my head no. Not alone, Stu. Not without you. I can't keep doing this, Marion. It hurts too much. It's time to go. What about Aaron and Anna? What about you? They're fine. We'll all be fine. Through the gate I hear the soft strum of a ukulele, the susurrus of waves on sand. A low, sweet voice begins crooning, Aloha, oh. Stuart stands, and suddenly I'm standing too. He reaches for me, and finally I can feel his hand take mine as he swirls me into one last waltz. 3 steps later, we're standing at the gate. Plumeria blossoms fill the air with nectar-sweet fragrance. I take a last look at Stuart's face. Do you think they'll let me have a window seat? I adjust the carry-on strap on my shoulder and brush back my hair. I took the middle so I could sit next to you. I'm sure they will, he says. One fond embrace, Marion, until we meet again. Stuart steps back to stand alone on the airport's white tile. The ukulele beckons. I step onto the jetway, and the scent of Plumeria carries me down the tunnel.
My name is Evelyn Evans, and I'm reading Games by James Valvis. The alien sat, if you called it sitting, in my treehouse as I tried to explain the game of Monopoly to him. No, 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 I said. You're stupider than Billy Ailes, and he's been left back twice. Boardwalk is yours. You bought it, and you own it. You just can't give it up. Maybe you can sell it, but if you hand over all your properties, you'll lose the game. The alien said, Losing the game is bad? I rolled my eyes at him. I'd already told him 3 times losing was bad. The alien smiled. At least I think he was smiling. We keep Boardwalk then? He was cool, very friendly, but his voice was kind of creepy. It didn't sound like one voice, but like many. Millions of them. Not loud, but like an echo. And echoes with echoes. As I understood it, every alien in the ship above was connected to the alien in my treehouse. When he spoke, they all spoke. What he heard, they all heard. What he learned, they all learned. And they had a lot to learn. Even the idea of money was weird to them. He started off by trying to eat the Monopoly bankroll I gave him. I had no idea how such a race was smart enough to travel all those light years to get here. But I also had to admit it was impressive how quickly he picked up my language. The object of the game, I went on, is to get everything. Leave nothing for anyone else? Right. Interesting, the alien said. He paused there, like there was a commotion in his mind, like the aliens back on the ship were arguing. It seemed a lot of bother over nothing. Are you ready to roll again? I said. We come to share, said the alien. He looked something like a mini predator, minus all the epic gear. He was about my height, but I got the feeling he was a grown-up. I mean, he gave off that vibe. We have much to share, but we now learn sharing, not desired. We learn now about properties, waterworks, railroads. We like to own. Owning better than jail. Don't like jail. Have to roll doubles to get out of jail. Right, I said. But you know, Monopoly kind of sucks. A game can take forever, and I guess you don't have forever. How about we play some chess? So we played chess. I had to teach him that as well. This alien, these aliens, didn't seem to know much of anything. I thought by starting them off on board games it would be easier, but no dice. Still, he caught on eventually. The hardest part for him wasn't learning the moves, but understanding that one piece had to take out the other piece. Why they cannot share space? Because, dummy, I said, it's no fun just moving pieces around the board. Someone has to win, and someone has to lose. Maybe Black Knight likes White Bishop. They can't like each other, I yelled. They're different. More murmuring in the background, more discussion, and perhaps a wince of pain in the face of the alien. Attacking is good, he said finally. Attacking is terrific, I assured him. It's the only way to win. It's the only way to make the game fun. We played some, and he wasn't very hard to beat. Checkmate, I said. It's the end of the game. I won. I made the right moves, and you lost. We play again? Sure. We played about 20 games, during which I learned his ship was as big as our moon, but invisible. And by the 20th game, he was way out of my league. It made sense. One sixth grader against the collected minds of all those aliens working together was a bit unfair. I was bored with chess anyway, so I pulled out my iPad and we played some video games. That started out disastrously as the board games. No, I said frustrated. You have to blast the people dead. God, you aliens are so ridiculous. You just want to walk around with your lasers and talk to people and heal them and everything? It doesn't work that way. You gotta shoot, or you die and your score is terrible. Here, let me show you how to fry those people. Frying people is good? Epic. Coolest game on earth. There was another conference in his brain. Then he said he had to go. He was happy to have met me before he met anyone else. I had given them a lot to think about, and they would talk about things for a time and then come back in a week. He said it would be a good idea if the people on our planet got ready to play games. He was sure after the talk and the manufacturing of some game pieces, there was going to be a lot of fun when he came back. That was 6 days ago, and I can't wait until tomorrow. It gets boring around here having no one to play with.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.